Support for this program. Support for this program is brought to you by Grey Wolf Computer Systems, providing a grant in support of this program. Grey Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. It is February 25th, 2005, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind, the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or its board, the Pataphysical Broadcasting Foundation. Today on Geek Speak, we have our very own Dee Dee Hubbard speaking a little bit about RSS, commonly known as Real Simple Syndication, a new way of using the web. During the first half of the show, of course, we will be taking, we're doing some geek news, and then we'll get into the RSS discussion, and then, of course, we'll be taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. That's all during the second half. Phone lines will be open 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can go to geekspeak.org. Click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Sean Cleveland, Technical Marketing Communications Manager for Transmeta, and Drew Meyer, Storage Specialist at AdaptTech. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, Lyle.
Good morning, Lyle.
Okay, Drew, you're not... Oh, you're on too. Hi, Drew. There we go.
That better. Thank you.
Thank you. Much more clear.
Now I exist. Thank you.
Before we get into our discussion about RSS, and actually let's go ahead and invite Dee Dee in as well if she'd like to join us. And Dee Dee, hi. Welcome to Geek Speak.
How's it going?
So, let's start, before we do our discussion about RSS, let's do a little bit of the news in geekdom. Drew, I'll start with you if you would like to cover your story for today.
Well, I'm excited because I'm a participant in the BOINC project, the Berkeley Open Infrastructure for Network Computing.
I'm glad you clarified what that was.
Yeah.
Say it one more time.
BOINC, Berkeley Open Infrastructure for Network Computing, BOINC.
What is Open Infrastructure for Network Computing?
So I'm sure that you're familiar, as are a lot of people, with the SETI at Home project, which is a project started by the scientists in the Space Science Lab at Berkeley to analyze radio signals coming in from outer space and look for signals that might be significant in terms of extraterrestrial. SETI at Home stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence at Home. The magic thing about this project, and what really got me fired up about it, is that they use the unused processor cycles or the idle time of your home computer to do the number crunching on this incredible volume of data. So you download a little bitty piece of software, run it on your computer, and every time your computer is idle, the SETI at Home application runs in the background and processes signals that it gets and exchanges with the central servers back at the Space Science Lab. It turns out that this idea really captured a lot of people's imaginations, and it's been the most successful, they call this distributed computing, it's been the most successful project ever. In fact, the combined power of everybody's little desktops and notebooks that have jumped into this, and it's a free project, you can just go and download the software, everybody's combined power is larger than the largest supercomputers ever invented. So it's exciting because scientists are getting, these guys are running on a shoestring budget. They're getting incredible volumes of data, and they're actually able to do something with the data, and they don't have to pay anybody to do it. And it doesn't cost you anything. So it just really excited me. Well, after a while, the SETI at Home project was so successful, other people started looking at the untapped valuable resource of computing power out on the planet, all these PCs that are proliferating, and usually they're more powerful than people can really make use of them, you know. who really needs a gigahertz processor when it comes down to it.
Or at least most of the time. You're typing a Word document, you're checking email, that thing is idle, not really working at all.
Sure, sure. And then think of the ones in corporations that are left on overnight or just sitting there that aren't.
Or at lunch.
Yeah, even an hour a day. So they put together this open infrastructure, which is essentially a software platform that other scientific projects can write their applications to, and everybody can take use of the same platform across the world.
The SETI one, for example, is very specific to the search for extraterrestrial life.
Yeah.
And that one is all designed around making sure that data about that radio frequency information that's picked up is processed. But this project, the Boink project that you're interested in, is much more about building a platform and then using that system as something that can be assigned tasks.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Boink is sort of a lower level than the SETI at home. SETI at home, consider that as an application that runs on Boink. And so now, rather than every scientific group writing their own special software and their own special customizations for each of their projects, they can write a project that is compliant with the Boink standard and the Boink platform, and everybody can share it and use it. The Boink platform can be used across multiple projects.
Right.
The best indication is just to go to the boink.berkeley.edu website and see all the variable projects. And the news, eventually what I'm going to get around to or talking about, is the news today. This week, two interesting things happened. First one is that climateprediction.net, which is a Boink project. This is a project to model long-term climate predictions of the global climate. When you think about it, it's an extremely sophisticated and difficult computer model.
Weather modeling is one of those top things. I mean, when you just take when you talk about a supercomputer, you're really talking about, in a lot of sense, weather modeling.
Yeah.
So go on.
And there's so much discussion about, is global warming real? Is it a threat? If it is real, does it make any difference? Are we causing it, et cetera? So this is an effort to just gather the data and process it and see what's happening and look for trends.
What a great idea to do that to have everybody a part of it, kind of.
Yeah, and they've spent, the latest experiment status is that the model has run for about 500 million years, it looks like, and that they've had several hundred thousand machines computing and adding results into this model, and they published some results in the journal Nature this week that were... Well, I'm not enough of a weather scientist to interpret that very well because Nature's a little over my head, but the fact that excites me is that they did actually achieve results and were able to publish them as true scientific data using everybody's free computing power or available computing power. And then the other exciting project that launched this week is called Einstein at Home, which is a method for analyzing gravity waves. It's a celebration of the World Year of Physics in 2005, and it lets... scientists look at gravity waves and see what's happening in terms of gravity wells and pulsars and heavy large objects and ultimately the origins of the universe. All right.
So some really cool projects on this supercomputer that's distributed, if you will.
Yeah, things that could never get done otherwise.
Get done. SETI, the SETI project, as you said, is one of the most successful. Distributed. How are people taking on this Boink project, and is SETI going to produce something that will ride onto this platform that Berkeley is doing?
Gotcha. So clarify that. Boink is a platform, and then everybody writes their own application. Climateprediction.net is an application. Einstein at Home is an application. And in this case, SETI has migrated their old SETI Classic version, which was independent, to the new SETI at Home, which runs on top of the Boink platform.
Great, great. So really we're looking at a better way of using these idle machines. Now, when I was doing SETI a while ago, I was working for a company that had a lot of idle machines, mm-hmm. development machines. And then, of course, my personal machine at work and at home when it was on, I was running it all over the place. And one of the things cool things about SETI on at home is that you get, when you make an account, and the more machines you add, the more processing you actually see the amount of process you've helped.
Yes.
And then Sean came along and kind of put a little bit of a damper on the SETI project, and there's a problem with hard drives. Sean, you want to tell me real quick what the SETI problem with hard drives is?
Yeah, they thrash them.
What do you mean?
They make the hard drives work harder than they need to. So it reduces the life of the hard drive over time.
So the processor is really underused, but a hard drive, the more you use it, the sooner it will fail. So the basic concept with one of these things is that it's putting data on the drive, it's reading data from the drive, it's putting data back on the drive, and it's basically... just like it's using the processor, it uses the drive.
Yeah, but I hear they've fixed that.
Yeah, that's what I've heard too. So that's a good thing. All right, we're going to go on. Thank you, Drew, for that. That's a great story. And
yeah, sure.
Are you one of the developers on that project, or are you just very keen?
I'm not a developer, but some of the storage products that I've worked with are used in the SETI at Home lab to store the data that comes from the radio telescopes. And so I got turned on to those guys through my job. And then when I learned about it, I just got really excited about it. And I'm definitely a participant in four or five projects today.
Great, thanks. We're going to go actually to Dee Dee, who has something about Microsoft changing its activations. And maybe, Sean, you know a little bit more about this as well. Dee Dee, please, what's up with Microsoft?
Microsoft's trying to curtail privacy by piracy.
Piracy, okay.
Maybe privacy, who knows?
Piracy by changing the way that some people might activate Windows. People who buy PCs from Dell or other big OEM retailers might now have to activate through the phone instead of online.
Oh, I see.
Activate through the phone? Call somebody?
Yeah.
That's the only way it's ever worked for me.
Windows allows you to activate XP and other products in certain ways, like online or on the phone. Maybe there's a third option. But I guess it's easier to trick the online client than...
It's funny because Sean and I, we talked about this a few weeks ago on GeekSpeak, and Sean was talking about how he always has to register via the phone.
Yeah, the online part never works for me.
And because of that, the process in doing that, you have to read this long code over to someone on the phone. They repeat it back to you. You confirm it by saying, yeah, that's it. Then they give you another number, which is actually longer, that you then have to put in and... Try starting it up.
It's a process.
So it is quite a bit of a process. Doing the online version is much simpler in a lot of ways. You just push a button and then it goes thinking, done. You're great, which is a little easier.
There go our software costs up again.
Yeah.
All these people on their phone.
You'd think that would be not very cost effective.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they just pass it on to you and I.
Yeah, I guess. Dee Dee, what's the reason for this? Do you know?
It's people who maybe like buy a Dell and want to sell it. And some people might sell the CD separately or sell it to multiple people. So I guess this is supposed to put a little bit more of a human touch to
that makes sense. One of the things
when really owns what.
When Microsoft first started doing this registration through their systems, basically it's not just a hash anymore. You actually have to contact Microsoft. They have a database lookup. Then they give you a key, and boom, you've got a successful install. One of the things that happens is it's pretty quickly becomes a problem if you restrict that install to only one machine. And so, because, for example, I buy a machine and then I upgrade the hard drive and the processor at the same time, and all of a sudden this machine, from Microsoft's perspective, looks like a new machine, but in reality it's the same one. So one of the things they did to curtail that problem was to allow Microsoft to be this product to be registered to like three different machines. The concept being that that's not really it's not really going to harm them. It's not like it's being spread to 1,000 machines. They're not going to lose a lot of money that way. And it just simplifies the amount of interaction that has to occur. But because of that, you could theoretically use your CD, install it, then sell your CD to somebody. They'd install it and register it, and both these machines would be functioning for a while. But that's really a breach on what Microsoft wants to do with their product. All right, thank you, Dee Dee, for that. Sean, I'm going to go to you, sir. You look ready to go.
Yeah, looks like Apple's taking a step away from FireWire.
Really?
Yeah.
What does Sony have to say about that?
I don't know. Apple invented FireWire.
But isn't Sony one of the big champions? I mean, you guys are more Apple-focused than I am.
Yeah, I think Sony calls it iLink.
Yeah, they've actually now started accepting FireWire. I mean, basically what you're saying is that the DV industry, the digital video industry, has accepted FireWire as kind of the accepted
Well, it doesn't
transfer.
Necessarily mean that digital video is moving away from it. I mean, it's always been there, even when FireWire wasn't doing well in the beginning.
The current PowerBook I have in Mac product I've got in front of me has got the standard FireWire and also FireWire 800, which is a faster FireWire. I haven't seen anything that plugs into the FireWire 800, so I'm not totally sure it's going to keep going. But are they talking about what their replacement will be? Are they just going to go to USB 2 and stick to that?
Yeah, they're going to USB 2.
Wow.
So what's happened is the iPod, when it first came out, was only FireWire.
Yeah.
And then they added USB 2. But you had to buy the cable separate. Now they're moving towards the model that you will get a USB 2 cable, but they're not going to include a FireWire cable. So what this is saying is that Apple's kind of not only saving a few bucks, but they're kind of admitting that USB is the way to go and not FireWire. USB is the dominant connection
technology. I personally like that. I mean, the one thing that USB really, the thing that irks me about USB is when you have a cable that's a 1.1 cable, a USB 1.1, or you have a machine or a hard drive that's USB 1.1, everything reverts to that level. That bus, if you will, reverts to that level of connection. And USB 1 is pitiful on connection speed.
Yeah, it's not so much the cable.
No?
I think any USB cable will work in 1.0.
No, I've had situations where extension cables reduce it to USB 1.
I used old, just to prove a point to myself, I grabbed an old USB cable.
And it was fine.
And it worked just fine at 2.0.
That's good to know.
But well, it's the device itself. If it's only, if a computer only has USB 1.0 and you hook up a USB 2 device to it, especially like an external hard drive, data transfer is pretty slow.
That's
pretty
thing
ugly.
That's the thing that makes FireWire look more appealing to me. I know that a FireWire connection is going to be nice and fast. I don't know, just by looking at the connectors, if a USB connection is going to be fast. It really, the USB connection has to do completely with whether it's USB 2.0, and you can't physically see that.
So at the last LAN party, this is hilarious. All the guys were all hooking up on our machines.
A LAN party is a collection of people bring computers together, connecting their own private network, and then playing some type of game.
We were passing patches back and forth. We were patching games, make sure we all had the same version. And Lyle had a hard drive. And he's like, so who's got, I've got FireWire drive here. No one had FireWire. And it's like, why don't you just use USB 2? He's like, well, nobody has USB 2. We're like, Lyle, we all have USB 2, except for you.
It was really frustrating. I guess that's what's happened, is I've gotten soured because my main motherboard at home only has USB 1. And you're right, that does kind of kill it. So basically Apple's saying, that aside, it made more sense to put 3 or 4 USB 2 connections on this machine, not have FireWire in it at all. And the more USB devices, the easier it is and simpler it is to configure.
Yep, yep.
I was, my mother's just moving out of the area, Diana Wright Troxell. She's actually on air all the time here at KOSP. And she's, when moving her machine and hooking up, she was really concerned about being able to plug it together without me. And I said, actually, you got an Apple, and if you can plug it in, then it's okay. You won't be able to plug the things into the wrong spot. There's no way to incorrectly put the thing back together. Make sure that all these cables plug into something, and your machine will be set up. And USB is one of the reasons that's so useful.
I had a problem with FireWire once at school. I was trying to plug in my FireWire drive, and I don't know, I guess the ports on the back were so jarred and screwed up from many, many students having used it over the years that I put it in backwards.
Oh, really?
And it actually fried one of my FireWire ports on my removable hard drive.
And we're talking about a FireWire port?
You got it in backwards?
Upside down?
Yes.
Wow, I can imagine a USB thing being jammed in wrong, but a FireWire...
Oh, you mean because one side is flat and the other side
is round.
Is rounded.
I got it in backwards.
Congratulations.
Okay.
And fried it.
I only have one FireWire port that works on my hard drive now. And the other one still has a little smell of burned.
I've got a bad FireWire port on one of my cards at home. I don't know how it happened, but it sure doesn't work.
My external hard drive, the FireWire went out.
That's right. Interesting. All right.
To go along with this story, yes. SanDisk is introducing the Ultra 2 SD Plus, a dual-purpose SD memory card with built-in USB. You know the little SD cards that go in your camera?
The little thumbnail size thing.
Yeah. So picture the back of it being on a hinge, and it lifts up to reveal a USB connector.
Ooh la la.
Kind of like this.
Oh, that picture is really useful on the radio, too.
Yes. So it's really hard to describe.
That's a great picture, Sean.
But an SD card is not, I mean, it's big enough. Certainly, it's, I don't know, maybe an inch.
It's about
long.
A pack of matches. A little thinner than a pack of matches.
Yeah, but it's not very thick, and I'm trying to figure out how the USB, I guess it's thick
enough.
It
looks like the USB is not the metal casing. It's just the slot inside the metal casing. Mm-hmm. When you look at a USB device, I wish I had something, or a cable in front of me.
Yeah, but a whole.
The metal shielding doesn't do anything. It's just there to protect the connection points.
Oh, I see.
So the actual connection points is this little slot thing. That's what that is.
So little SD cards, anybody who has a camera that uses SD will know what we're talking about. This thing works with any SD slot.
And is it USB 2?
And in the back of it pops up to reveal a USB
2. That's nice because you don't have a card reader. I like that idea.
So you just pull the memory out of your machine, out of your camera, and just plug it into any USB slot.
And download the pictures from there.
Move the pictures off.
That's cool. I hope it happens with the other types.
So
as
that
well.
That is from SanDisk, who's the inventor of flash removable memory. It's the SanDisk Ultra 2 product line, and it'll come in 512 meg and 1 gigabyte versions.
It's great. All right, I've got a quick note that's going to take us into our discussion for the day. Firefox 1.01 has been released. Firefox is the browser of choice for a lot of people at this point, I believe. It's from Mozilla. It's a free web browser. You can, if you're on a Windows machine, if you're not using Firefox, if you're still using Internet Explorer, I highly recommend you use Firefox as your primary browser. And then when you absolutely need Internet Explorer, switch to Internet Explorer. Reason being that Internet Explorer traditionally has security breaches. It's also not very friendly in the world of standards, if you will. So in any case, Firefox, you can get Firefox by going to mozilla.org and clicking around for Firefox. They've got installs for almost every version. I don't think they have Macintosh OS 9 and below, but they do have Windows and Linux and Mac OS 10. Highly recommend that browser. One of the great features of that browser is its ability to be extended easily. The development to make add-on pieces and such in an environment I think called Zool, but I'm not exactly sure what it is. You can produce new plugins and interesting things like different bookmark managers or RSS readers. And so we're going to go into our discussion now about RSS. Didi wrote us a quick introduction to RSS. We have on geekspeak.org if you'd like to read up about it. RSS, though Didi's not going to specify the acronym, I've always defined it as real simple syndication. Didi, what is RSS?
RSS is XML, and the long and short of it. It's XML that sort of summarizes content on websites. So if it's about news, then it might give you a brief description and the headline. So you can have a feed reader or something else that can understand RSS, which will pick up on all the changes that are happening on the site and spit you back the headlines and the descriptions. So you can go to the site and read more if you want based on the information that the RSS feed is giving you. So I can keep track of hundreds of news sources without having to visit them every day, just because my feed reader will tell me when there's new content that I actually want to read.
Okay, well, I'm going to go a little bit more into the XML part of what you just said. And XML is this thing that people spit around all the time. It's very big in web development. It's very big in application development now. It's kind of being used all over the place. And generally, people might be more familiar with other forms of ways of transferring large data or data in between different applications. Common thing in the workplace is to have a tabbed eliminated file. So let's say you have a FileMaker database or some other thing that has a whole bunch of information, and you want to do a mail merge with Microsoft Word, for example. Pretty common thing in a business practice. You want to send out a whole bunch of letters. What you would do from the Excel sheet that has all the people in it, or from a FileMaker system that has all these people, is you'd export what's called a tabbed eliminated file. And that would be a person's first name and last name and phone number, or first name, last name, address, street, city, and so on. And that string would kind of, you'd have hundreds of those for every person you want to send a letter to. So then you open up your Word document, you say, merge this document with this tabbed eliminated file and create individual letters for each person and mailing address labels for each person. That's how it's kind of done, and from a simple perspective in business, in small businesses, or even sometimes, you know, people do this kind of thing for sending out their yearly family update letters. Now, the problem with the tabbed eliminated file, though you can open it up and read it because it's just text, and every person, every segment of data, there's a tab in between there, and then there's carriage returns to make the next set of data. So the geeks, you know, there's five of us or six of us, so there'd be six lines to find the geeks' addresses, for example, in a tabbed eliminated file. The problem with that is that if you don't know what is the first thing in the list, if you don't know that the first name is the first segment is first names and the second is last names, and then the street address is the third thing down, it gets really kind of complicated to try to figure it out. And that's kind of the benefit of this thing called XML, or extensible markup language. And it looks a lot like HTML, but in general what it is, it's a way of making a text document help define the data that you're looking at. So in an XML document, that same information that is normally just separated with tabs in a tabbed limited file would have things like first name, and then a name happen, and then close first name, and then last name, and then the name would be there, and close last name. So when you look at it, you open it up, you can see the data. It's clear to figure out how to write and use that data. It's self-defining. And that's why it's such a yummy thing to use in spreading and sharing data. So RSS allows you to, it makes a skeleton structure for an XML document that defines stories on the web. That's all it is. And when you combine that with a cool thing like a Firefox plugin that does RSS viewing, you're able to look at CNN's newsfeed without going to CNN.com and without loading all their images, without running the JavaScript, without doing all the stuff that involves going to the machine. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that. We're going to take calls in moments from now. So Dee Dee, stay with us, please. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com.
This week in This American Life, in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, anybody at the Ramada Inn will tell you, the hotel's haunted. Though not in any of the normal spooky ways that we normally think of as haunting. The ghost switches the TV channels in the rooms to C-SPAN, his favorite.
The computer. It just beeps all the time, and then I just tell it to shut up, because I think it's Walter.
Be sure to listen. We'll leave the light on for you.
That's This American Life, Sunday at 10 a.m. on KUSP.
You're listening to Geek Speak on KSP. If you have questions or comments, the numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can use the Internet, visit geekspeak.org, and click on Contact Us. While there you can look also at an article by Dee Dee about RSS, our topic of the day. In the air with me, Drew Meyer, Sean Cleveland over the Internet, Dee Dee Hubbard. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services including DSL, spam filters, PHP, and MySQL. Now with nationwide access, information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. If you're listening to Geek Speak, my name is Lyle Troxell. Sean?
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
So maybe an XML explanation for the rest of the listeners out there?
Sure, go ahead.
Not Geek Speak?
Okay.
I don't know. What I want to know is, what makes it different than HTML? What can you do with XML that you cannot do with HTML?
Okay.
I mean, if I were visiting a site, would I know the difference? Would I care? Would it change the way things work in the background? Or does it just make it easier for the developer?
No. It's a totally different way of looking at it. HTML is, the newest version of HTML is actually an XML document. That's first off. HTML falls into the standard of an XML document, which means that it is marked up in such a way that when you look at the raw source of it, you understand what things are. But the difference is that HTML was designed to render things or make things look a certain way. So in HTML document, there is a title that is what shows up at the top of the web page you're visiting above outside of the content. And then there are these things called like H1s, which are headline ones. And normally what you should do when you're producing a page is you should make H1, a type level H1, define the title again, what the page is, because the person will see that. So you'll make the title again in an H1. Or maybe you'll put the author in an H3, a headline 3, because you want to say that this was written by Sean Cleveland. So when you look at the page, the title will be the biggest thing because it's in an H1, and the smaller thing will be
right.
Sean Cleveland.
Your text is
pieces.
Not cluttered by code.
Right.
HTML code.
But when you view it through a browser. But when you look at that content and you want to use that, if I wanted to put that up on GeekSpeak, I want to put feeds of your articles, for example, all I would know is that there was an H1 coming at me and an H2, and it had content in it. And I wouldn't be able to say that the H1 is the title. Maybe it isn't. Maybe it's your bio page, and the H1 is your name, and the H2 is your title at Transmeta. So you don't know by looking at the document what those things are. If you make an XML document that's clearly for sharing content of that nature, you would have something that would be called author. And in the author name would be your name, for example. You know, oh, this is an article we're talking about. And then there would be a title. And then there would be a description. And these things are self-defining on what they are, so that when I look at your XML documents, I can implement them pretty successfully. We're going to go to a call. We have Steve Goodman, who's been waiting patiently for a while. Steve, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, good. Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I don't have a question about XML.
But you called when we were talking about FireWire. So
right. Well, you know... Personally, I've been loving FireWire. I actually came in a little late, so I heard something about dropping FireWire.
Yeah, AMD is Apple.
Yeah.
Apple is moving away from FireWire. They're still going to have the port on the newest iPods. They're just not going to ship a cable.
Because I just spent $500. I got a nice 500 gigabyte FireWire drive that this particular one only came with 400 and 800 ports, no USB port on it. So,
right.
I mean, is this going to be obsolete for me?
It sounds like if you bought a new Macintosh that didn't have FireWire, that drive wouldn't be very usable.
Uh-huh.
And that is kind of frustrating. You can probably, I'm assuming that there's ways to convert a FireWire to a USB. It would be an expensive little piece of equipment, but I bet you anything Apple's going to make sure that somebody provides it so that you can buy your new, you know, G7, whatever the new Mac is, and still use your old equipment. The other thing is you can always buy a new enclosure and use the same hard drive. And the real expensive part is the hard drive in this scenario. Normally, if you're getting a large hard drive,
yeah,
you can always get a new enclosure.
Yeah, but if you have FireWire in your machine's going to last a few years. So
you're
going to have that. But the thing is, you know, they're always looking for ways to cut costs. OEMs who build machines and these device makers. So, by not including a cable, that probably saves them $15-$20. I wouldn't be surprised if people start backing away from it now.
Well, I really appreciate what you brought up because I was just getting ready to buy another one, and now I'm obviously
I'm
going to wait.
It's actually really common to be able to get a FireWire and USB in one. So an enclosure that has USB.
Most of them came that way now.
Yeah.
Well, actually, the other four, I have two 120 gigs and two 160 gigs, and they had all of them.
Yeah,
this one just came with the.
Yeah, you know, they're trying to cut costs. People know, you know.
Actually, they did have a same version that had the USB.
There you go. So now when you buy one, get this that one as well.
Yeah.
If anyone's interested in FireWire and USB devices, Santa Cruz-based Seagate is a great supplier of those. I have one of their drives. It's a 160 gig, I believe, and it's got a FireWire and a USB. You can't. One thing that I wish you could do, because for example, Sean's laptop FireWire doesn't work anymore. It would be great if you could plug in one of those drives into your USB connection on your computer, and then plug a FireWire connection, another drive into the FireWire part,
right.
Because they normally have multiple ports, and be able to read the FireWire through that. Unfortunately, that's not something that normally is supported or is ever supported. But Steve, thank you for the call.
Well,
was there?
I have one other question. Can
please do, Steve.
Okay, I've got. PowerBook, it's probably just like yours, Lyle. It's the 17-inch, it's 17-inch G4.
Okay.
I oftentimes have trouble shutting it down or restarting it, and I use, you know, not only trying to use the menu or the command option escape or some of the other tricks that Apple has on their website, and oftentimes it's not necessarily frozen, but nothing will happen. I'll go up to the Apple menu and go to restart or shut down, and it just... It'll start to do it, and it just won't do it.
So basically, is this a titanium or aluminum?
Yes.
So you're not able to shut down your aluminum. It ignores your command at all, completely. You go to shut down,
yep.
You do the shutdown, and then bum, 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 and pretty soon nothing. No error message or anything?
Nope, just won't do it.
Didi, are you understanding this question about a machine, not a PowerBook not shutting down? Do you have any thoughts on why that might be happening?
it might be a rogue process that it's trying to close before, because when you choose shutdown from the Apple menu, it tries to save and close your work from all the applications that are open that support that. And so if there's an application that's not responding, it can cancel the shutdown.
Yeah. Now can it, Didi, when it cancels the shutdown, doesn't the operating system tell you that something canceled it? I mean, shouldn't it give you a message?
A little message will pop up saying, so-and-so is blocking shutdown. Would you like to, you know...
Force them out, yeah.
Shutdown?
Well, the other thing I'm thinking is that it's possible it's something that's keeping the machine awake, but I think that's probably the best bet is that you've got an application that's running. Steve, have you upgraded to the most recent version of Panther?
I'll tell you what I got.
Mac OS is starting to sound
10.3.
Like Windows now.
10.3.5, okay. Well, I don't have a quick answer for you. I think it's kind of strange. I would definitely try getting rid of, you know, unplugging all the peripherals from the machine. If it's a laptop, yeah, unplug all the peripherals. And try to shut it down and see if that's one of the situations is that there's a connection, like a USB or
something. It sounds like
a
job for John. Maybe you should send us an email.
Unfortunately, Steve, I think John's the best answer, and he's not on the show because he's got a job that's in the morning. So if you'd like to send us an email, go to geekspeak.org or just use my email address. You happen to know it, I think. And we'll get John to help
you
out.
If you really need to shut it down.
All right, well, thanks for all your time.
And if Didi says if you really need to shut it down, yeah, please.
What's that?
Shut it down right now. Control Apple power button.
Control Apple power button.
It's like the hard stop, pull it all out.
Okay.
Bells and whistles ringing.
So try that, Steve. Control Apple power down, and that will get that thing off. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Sean Cleveland, Drew Meyer, and Dee Dee Hubbard. And we are taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or use the Internet. Visit geekspeak.org or click on Contact Us. Let's get back into the RSS discussion while we're waiting for calls. It is open if you want to give us a call. Again, 476-2800.
Actually, I wanted to pick
toll-free at 1-800-655-5877.
I didn't know you were going to do the 800 number.
Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Dee Dee, where can I find some cool RSS feeds? Is it through the software? Because I'm just using Thunderbird right now. And, you know, it just gives me an interface to add feeds. But
I saw Dee Dee's recommendation of Sage, and I installed that as one of the extensions for my Mozilla Firefox browser. And I actually get information about the Boink project from my RSS feed all on one page.
Pretty
oh,
cool.
Wow.
So it's an extension that in the experience that I had, I just went to the Mozilla's the Firefox site and looked at the extensions. And you can do that through the tools menu in your browser and download the Sage application or the Sage extension. You can find Sage just by searching for it on the extension.
So Sage actually shows you a bunch of RSS feeds that are available?
Sage has like a couple installed automatically.
Oh, okay.
But the clever thing about Sage, if I may, Drew, is it gives you a sidebar on the left-hand side which you can hide and show, and there's a little magnifying glass on that sidebar. And so you visit a site that has an RSS feed, potentially, and you think, well, it probably does, and you push that little magnifying glass and the icon, thank you. And what you get is that it looks through the code on that page and finds any links to RSS. Then it loads those RSS files and grabs the titles of them from the RSS file, and then it displays them and says which one do you want. So, for example, after you install, once you're using Firefox and you install something like Sage, and then you go to geekspeak.org's homepage, there'll be a little orange icon in the bottom right that says RSS, kind of like the icons where the images we're using for today's show and for Dee Dee's article up on geekspeak.org. And when you see that icon, what you can do is just click on that little, again, magnifying glass, and it'll pop up with GeekSpeak shows. And you'll say yes, and then anytime you want to know what the show is that just happened, it's a history of shows, you can click on your RSS link, and boom, you'll see the show title. We'll be changing that soon to have the most recent upcoming show, but it's a great way to not have to load, for example, geekspeak.org or any other site, and keep track of what's happening in the world.
I don't really get it, Lyle, honestly. I mean,
why not?
Well, what's the point? I mean, by the time I download the extension, and this has been my experience, I downloaded the extension, installed it, and I run it, and it shows up on the left-hand side of my browser page, and there's a couple of locations there. I might as well go to each of these sites and read the words on the site and extract the information. It doesn't seem to add a lot for me.
Dee Dee, what's the big deal?
The big deal is for all the information junkies, like myself, who don't want to visit 200 sites a day just to find out, oh, nothing's been changed. And so for all the sites that I tend to like to visit on a regular basis, I check to see if they have an RSS feed. And I also search out sites particularly that have RSS feeds because it makes it easier for me to be in touch and to be on top of things.
It's kind of nice to have those news organizations.
If I'm going to be browsing anyway, I'll open up Sage, I'll hit check feeds, and it'll tell me that, oh, 10 news sites have new stuff, and I can look at the new stuff before I even go there. So, like, if I'm not interested in baby was thrown out with the bathwater yesterday, I don't have to go and visit that.
And load all its images and load all the content.
It is sending the information to you instead of you having to go after.
Kind of, not really. Actually, I mean, your system's still getting the information, going and getting the information.
You're getting the headlines.
It's doing kind of in the background.
And then you can decide to look at them or not.
There are some RSS feeders that will check the feeds every 5 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't, for the most part, it's not such a big hit for the website to download 100 full content pages versus just tiny XML feed. So visiting each site 5 times every hour is not a big deal for most websites. And so it can be running in the background, and then you can load it up, and it'll tell you exactly what's new for
now. One of the clever things about something like the Sage plugin is what it does is when you add your bookmark in, it goes and gets that XML feed, this RSS feed. It gives you the titles, and it caches that information. And also when that was picked up. And then you go back to your system. You say, okay, I want to update everything. And you push update. Let's say you have like 4 sites on the left-hand side, and which sites And then you can look at each one of those feeds and determine what the most recent stories are. What it will do is twofold. One, it will put a little star on those sites that have updated since last you looked. And it will also bold any articles that you've actually, or it will bold articles that you haven't clicked on and therefore you haven't read. So when you start doing it, for example, GeekSpeak is a perfect example. Everybody wants to know what's happening on for us on GeekSpeak, but our content changes about weekly. It doesn't change every day. And sometimes we put articles up throughout the week, like this article of Dee Dee's that was put up a few days ago about RSS, which might be interesting. And what the clever thing about this is you don't have to go keep on visiting these sites that don't update every day. You don't have to visit them every day. And still, you can, when it does get updated, know it's been updated and read the article. So you can be on top of it without spending the time looking at every site. And that's one of the major features of it. The other thing I personally like about it is when you go to all these sites like CNN or Google News or a lot of these sites, there is a lot of content on that page that is information I don't need on a daily basis. I go to CNN.com, for example, to read the news. I do not go to find out about the company CNN.com or about the show listings or all these other links and data that's on that page. That's not what I'm going to do that for. I'm going to find out the last, five headlines, what's going on in the world. So loading all that navigation, all those images, all that other stuff is a waste of the resources available to me at the internet. I have to copy those to my machine. My machine has to render them in front of me and make them viewable. That's not stuff I need to do, so don't do it. That's kind of the idea. Also, it doesn't hurt CNN.com because you're not like stealing the information and harvesting it. You're only getting the headlines and a little abstract. And because of that, when you do go, I want to read this, and you click it, they still get their hit. They still get their advertising dollars, whatever their system runs. So it's very, very clever, I believe. Did you want to add anything to that?
Well, some RSS feeds will actually render the HTML page in its own little browser window. Or in the case of Sage, you have the option of it rendering the articles in a sort of minimalist style with just text and links and highlights and some images that are included in the actual content. Or you can have it take you to the actual site, which is what I've switched over to. Actually, but the thing that I'm really plugging about RSS is that I can be an information junkie and still have. I feel like I still have a life. I don't know. you can tell me.
That's debatable. We're gonna go to. No, you do, Dee Dee. Of course, we're gonna go to. Let's see, Santa Cruz. Sky, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hi, Sky. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, how you doing?
Quite well, thank you. What's your question?
I bought a secondhand Sony Vaio for my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't running very well. Every time we got it online, it would go for a little while, and then it would get booted off. And we took it into the local computer shop to see what they could do. And they took a look at it and also tried to install an upgrade on the memory. And
that makes sense. Machine's running slow. Increase the memory. Okay.
And long story short, he said he'd never seen anything like it before, but the computer wouldn't accept any memory. It only had 64 to start off with.
You mean it had a slot available and it wouldn't recognize it?
Yeah, it had slots available, but it wouldn't recognize it at all.
Wow. Is the BIOS the latest version?
What's that?
Is the latest version of the BIOS installed that supports RAM over a certain threshold?
I'm not sure. Really.
You might need to get special memory directly from Sony.
I would assume that as well. You'd have to have that memory stick.
Compaq was famous for that.
Yeah, that's... Because I guess you said he tried several different types of memory, and it just wouldn't recognize it at all.
It came with 64 megs. So I'm going to place this as about a six-year-old machine, five-year-old.
Uh-huh.
Is that about
five? Yeah, I think so.
Now, is the 64 megs soldered down on the motherboard, or is it
in a slot?
I don't know. I just gave it to him, and that's what he told me.
Sean, we upgraded Sony Vaio when Miles was using Sony Vaio. Do you recall upgrading that? Didn't we add memory to that?
We did.
And it was just laptop memory.
Yeah, it worked.
You might want to go to Crucial.com, which is Micron Technology's retail arm, and they're an industry manufacturer, the largest in the United States and one of the largest in the world, and they make RAM for everybody's type of computer, and they have a superb configurator, which is why I recommend the Crucial site. They tell them exactly what machine you have, what model, and and they ask a few simple questions, and they'll recommend exactly the right type of RAM for your box.
And you can always give that a shot. Now, opening up a VIO is a dangerous process. They're very tightly. The VIO is an extremely thin, small machine. Therefore, everything's packed in there really tight. When we did this, when I worked on the VIO that I worked on, I destroyed the battery charging capabilities of the laptop. And
that's interesting because the battery in this machine is dead, and it seems.
Does it take a charge?
Did you buy it new? Was it
yours? No, I bought it secondhand.
Yeah, the charging thing on the vial, that's exactly what happened, the one we had. It was opened up and it was put back together, and we couldn't get the battery to ever be used again. It wouldn't charge. It wouldn't really recognize that the battery is plugged in, or
right,
at
exactly.
least it wouldn't start it. Yeah, you're probably having the same thing. I wonder if Miles actually sold that machine and Sky's got it at this point. I don't think so. One of those risks about buying stuff online.
No, he didn't.
No, he didn't. Sky, thanks for the call. I'm sorry we weren't able to be more helpful to you.
Good luck.
Good luck.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
I ended up giving that machine to a friend of mine who's a trucker.
Oh, cool. And he can plug it in all the time.
Yeah.
Great. Perfect solution. All right. From Santa Cruz, Marianne, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm not sure if it's something you guys want to tackle, but I'm actually an elementary school teacher. I have a small network at an elementary school running Windows 2000 Advanced Server. I have Macintosh, AppleShare clients, you know, OS9 clients. I have PC, Windows 2000 clients.
You're doing the whole gambit of computers
This is elementary school. You use what you have.
Yeah. Right.
She's a better geek than we are.
I know.
Oh, boy. I'm hitting the wall with this one. Now I'm trying to add OS 10 clients on the same network, mm-hmm. same server. I'm trying to run a program that uses a shared database. It's put out by Scholastic. It's a reading company. Where kids go on and they take little quizzes. Okay. Well, everything's fine until I add these OS 10 clients on the network and use that program. It's as if that OS 10 client machine almost takes ownership of the network and precludes anybody else from using the network at the same time.
All right.
They get a variety of error messages like, oh, the system's locked by an administrator or, you know, a variety of different error messages. All solved by rebooting my server and kicking everybody off, and everything's fine until an OS 10 client tries to use this program, which has unlimited licensing. It's designed to be used simultaneously by many people.
But basically, you can connect the Mac OS 10 clients to the network. Everything
yep.
works
mm-hmm.
great, and then if you run this application from one of the Macs,
yep.
then things just fall apart on your network.
Well, if I run it from one of the Macs, exactly, it's fine. First Mac is happy. I just can't get a second Mac on, or a second PC, or a second. OS 9 Mac.
And this doesn't happen with the Windows versions of this product?
Nope.
Wow. So
and they claim it's OS 10 compatible. I've been on tech support with them, and they keep having me check permissions, but
yeah.
you know, we've been
I'm thinking that you have a license for this, right?
Oh, yeah. Everything.
I bet you anything it has to do with the licensing. Like, the version that you're running OS 10 isn't the correctly licensed version. But it seems a little strange to me.
I don't have trouble file sharing. You know, I can mount that shared drive right on the desktop. It sees the program. The first computer's happy, but like I say, it almost feels like it's taking ownership of the network somehow.
So are you using NFS to share the volume to the Mac OS 10 clients or Apple Share?
I'm not sure. Oh, the OS 10 is NFS, I think. Yeah,
NFS.
It's not
so
Apple Share. It's only
you have Unix services for Windows running on that 2000 server?
Unix services for Windows. Now, that's something I haven't.
Well, if you're using NFS, then you're probably doing that.
I haven't specifically set that up. Again, I learn as I go. And so
okay.
This application that you run, are you running? You're running it from the machine in question.
The Windows 2000.
Slow down. Is that on the Windows 2000 server?
The application is mounted locally on the client.
Okay.
But it's accessing a shared database on this server.
So the application runs from the client, and the data mm-hmm. happens to be stored out on the server.
Yes.
So that everybody can get to it.
You have to read and write to that data folder.
Do you know if you have to set up a share for that to happen, or if it normally just works? You don't have to actually connect a share.
You do have to connect a share.
So it's accessing the file system on those other machines.
And I have set up the files.
We probably have an answer. Drew, I'll let you take a stab at it.
Well, I'm guessing that the permissions on your Windows share are not set correctly to have all those Mac clients simultaneously accessing that share.
And where would I look to set that? I've looked at the share folder itself and
mm-hmm.
been through it, you know, made it full access, read-write for everyone. Oh, one more additional thing is, which might be key, is I've set up a shared login I have a generic student login. Yes.
Oh, okay. Well,
I've tried. I've tried setting up unique logins for the OS 10 machines. It didn't seem to make any difference.
Okay, you have a domain run. You said this is a domain server, right?
No, we have a network without a domain.
It's a work group.
Yeah, it's a work group.
And so everybody, each machine has a local
account.
Has a local user that when they turn on the OS 10 machine and somebody puts in their username and password and then they get authenticated to all the resources on the network.
Bingo. And now I have a shared I set it up originally with shared login, and that's what I've been doing in the Apple Talk and the Windows, and that's fine. But now with this OS 10, I'm wondering if that's
fine. I think we're going to get to the answer to this, but I think it's getting to the point where I'm starting to lose control of the conversation. So, and if I'm lost about what's going on, I'm assuming that a thousand people are. So, what I'd like to do is I'd like to answer your question. I'd like you to send us an email, and Drew will keep the conversation going, and I will keep the conversation going with you through the internet. Thank you very much. Go to our website. Thank you very
much,
Marianne.
All right.
I like being able to support an elementary school. It's kind of a rewarding thing. We're going to go on to the next call from Santa Cruz. Stacy, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello, good morning.
Hello and good morning.
I think I have a fairly simple question. I have a Macintosh iBook G4, and when I turn it on, before it boots, there's a flashing question mark in the middle of the screen, and it's been doing it for a long time. Somebody told me that my computer is asking me a question.
I
don't know what it is.
All right, so basically you can't start your machine, ever.
No, it starts. It runs fine. But when I pull up my Finder, it also has two question marks in the corner of the Finder. And everything runs okay. I mean, sometimes things will just randomly shut down. But everything runs okay.
The hard drives have these icons that are question marks?
I don't know if it comes from the hard drive. It might.
I'm sorry. So your machine boots up. Everything starts. You can run applications and everything. If you open up a folder and you see the lists of things, sometimes there's question marks on them.
Very right corner of the Finder, in the gray box, there are two question marks.
The gray box in the right-hand corner of there are two question marks. I have no idea what... In the upper bar in the top?
Yeah, it's basically the format of the Finder. When you pull up Finder, It just has two question marks in the format of the gray that surrounds all of the files. It's not in any of the files.
Okay, and we're talking. That's okay. Oh, phew. I know what we're talking about. So we're talking about like Jaguar OS 10.2 earlier. Okay.
You're old.
Yeah.
No, okay. It's
not. It's you have a very simple problem. It's nothing you have to worry about. So, basically, the older Finder, not OS 10.3, but the earlier cats, the non-Panther cat. The bar at the top, that gray bar, it has shortcuts. You can put things up there and then be able to click on them, and it launches them. Those question marks means that something was put up there, meaning a shortcut was put up there, and then the actual original file was deleted. So now the system's like, I've got shortcuts there, but I don't know what to do with them. So when you click on them, it shouldn't do anything, and the question marks just stay there. So all you have to do is remove them. And I can't remember how to do that. But
okay. I go in and remove shortcuts.
Dee Dee, do you remember how to remove those?
You just drag them off and let go, and it goes poof.
Yeah, grab that. That's what I was assuming that would work. Grab
poof.
That. Click on that question mark.
That must be a Mac term.
It likes a little poofing cloud.
Put
your cursor on that little question mark and click down, holding down, and drag it off of that bar area and let go. And it should go poof, and it's all gone. So there you go.
Right on.
Good
success.
Success, I hope. I hope that works. Good luck. I think that worked in that version. We're unfortunately not going to be able to take Bill from Templeton. Bill, please do send us an email. Go into geekspeak.org, click on Contact Us, and we will get to you via the internet. I appreciate you being here, but can't put you on air. Grey Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Grey Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. The geeks this morning were Sean Cleveland, and were Drew Meyer and, of course, Dee Dee Hubbard, who talked to us about a little bit about RSS. If you're more interested in RSS and using the Internet in different ways, please go to geekspeak.org. On the right-hand side, you'll see an article by Dee Dee, and you can start using it right away. Of course, the recommendation that Dee Dee is using is to go to Firefox, and I highly recommend it as well, unless, of course, you're on OS 9. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland, and, of course, all of you listening to GeekSpeak, thank you very much. And, of course, those that called in, thank you for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it might just be us geeking out. And, you know, who really wants to listen to that? Geeks, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Lyle.
Our pleasure.
And, Dee Dee, thank you for virtually being here.
Woo-hoo.
Poof. There she goes.
We'll be back next week. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support service. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is GeekSpeak, Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KDH San Ardo, or on the web at kusp.org. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Several American soldiers were caught in a deadly bombing north of Baghdad today. The military says three service members were killed and another eight were wounded. From the Iraqi capital, NPR's Anthony Kuhn has more details on the surprise attack.
There was a foot patrol of U.S. soldiers. They were from Task Force Baghdad, and they were patrolling in Tarmia, which is north of the capital. And they were hit by a roadside bomb. Some people say it may have been concealed in a stand of palm trees by the road. Eyewitnesses said that U.S. troops and Iraqi security forces later cleared the area, sealed it off, and then brought in helicopters to evacuate the wounded.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn. Iraqi authorities say they've arrested a key ally to the most wanted terrorism leader in the country. Today, forces announced they arrested a man known as Abu Qutaiba. He's accused of being a close aide to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. A court stay is set to expire this afternoon in the case of Terry Schiavo, the brain-damaged Florida woman who is being kept alive by a feeding tube. As NPR's Ari Shapiro reports, another government agency has recently entered the dispute over the woman's fate.
Florida's Department of Children and Families is now trying to...